My name is Rob Auchincloss, and this is the Holocene Podcast, where we seek knowledge from the most creative, adventurous, and bright among us. These individuals are storytellers, entrepreneurs, athletes, designers, and everything else in between. It is my job as the host to take what they have each learned in their own lives and codify their knowledge so that you can use their lessons in your own life. Today's episode of the Holocene Podcast is sponsored by the Holocene Magazine. You can purchase the first issue online and pre-order the second one now, which will come out very soon. Today, I am joined by Jay Goldstein. Jay is the founder and CEO of Founder to Leader, a coaching company that equips biotech leaders for scale. Previously, she was on the founding team of Petri Venture Capital, founded and scaled a lab at MIT to help engineers learn to communicate effectively, the MIT Comm Lab, and oversaw education innovation across Harvard University. Jay and I have a wide-ranging conversation on everything from startups to raising children to understanding the larger world as itself. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation.
Life is either an incredible adventure or it's nothing at all.
Jay, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Of course. So I start off every podcast by asking the same question, which is, what is the first thing you think about when you wake up in the morning?
That is such a good question. I usually think about all the things I have to do and then think, all right, where should I get started?
Do you have a syntax or like a to-do list or like how do you prioritize and arrange how you get things done?
Well, so as an executive coach, I think about this stuff all the time, right? About how to improve my own personal productivity as well as helping my clients think about this stuff too. So yeah, I'm like constantly trying to tweak my perfection about how to optimize my own impact in a day. So I use Notion as a way of keeping myself organized. Big fan. Big fan of call it calendar blocking, and do a lot of work to really think about my own needs, all the things I need to get done for myself, for my clients, for my son. I'm constantly revisiting it to see if there's a better way to do it.
Cool. Do you have any that so this ties into kind of the to-do list agenda? Do you have any morning rituals or routines? I mean, you said 11-year-old son, so I'm sure that's a big part of the morning ritual, right? Yeah. What does that look like?
Yeah. So I wake up at 5 every day. I am a morning person, and I find that between 5 and 6 is my like peak productivity hour. So I usually sit down in the kitchen and get a lot of quiet work done before my son wakes up. He wakes up usually between 6 and 6:30. And then I get him ready for school. And after he goes to school, that's when my work day starts. But yeah, we have a lot of things we do to make sure he's ready for school. And then at 8:30, I'm ready to crush my day. And I'm very client facing. So that hour of quiet time in the morning is really important for me to get my head on straight, for me to center myself, and also for me to get any critical tasks done before I get sort of pulled into client work for the majority of my day.
So going off that, what is a bad day look like then? Like what is something that you've realized that if it doesn't happen, it sounds like it's that hour of quiet time. Like if you don't get that, it seems like it kind of derails everything else, right?
It really does. Also, I need exercise. That's something for me. I need about, 30 to 45 minutes of like cardio exercise every day for myself. I've also learned that after about every 3 hours of people time as an introvert, I need about 15 minutes of silence. You know that, huh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm one of those like introverts that looks like an extrovert and you don't know it, but I get really fried once I spend too much time with people. So I have to really take care to balance opportunity to retreat a little bit every day. Or else if I get to the end of the day and I haven't taken care of that need to have silence and quiet, I find I'm just really depleted.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that something you said I really vibe with, not to use a better word, but like this idea that I come across as an extrovert and I tell people I'm an introvert. And they're like, there's no way you're an introvert. And I'm like, I promise you, I am an introvert. So let me ask, because I'm always curious. So my girlfriend is also heavily an introvert, and I found that like introverts almost always attract. Do you find that to be a similar case in your world, or?
You know, I don't know. I think I have a lot of people in my world who probably are right on that cusp, like me. I love people. I love being with people. I do much better one-on-one or in very small groups with people.
Sure.
And I also really need quiet. And, you know, like when you do the Myers-Briggs or any of those, they're always like, would you rather go to a party or stay at home? It's always stay at home for me. Always.
Yeah. So you're a, I'm guessing probably an INTP or an INTJ.
I'm an IE. So right on the cusp of that INE.
Me too.
And TJ.
Got it.
Yeah.
Cool. Nice. I figured. Yeah. So I immediately knew that you and I were going to be near the same. And depending on which day I take it or even what time of day, you're an I. And it's like, it's right on there in that.
Yeah.
Have you ever done this thing called a pro scan?
No, what's that?
So I heard about it recently. I sit on this nonprofit board that's all around, you know, like education for undergrad aged kids. That's about let me try to think of a pithy way to describe it. Think about like teaching real leadership, which already sounds dumb, but like kind of like the idea of that, you know, being transparent and true to yourself and figuring out yourself first before you can help other people, like that kind of stuff. And one of the things we do is social styles, is like a well-known, used by corporations. I'm the biggest fan of it. I think it's great for someone like me who sometimes can be a bulldozer in a conversation and become a better listener, right? Mm-hmm. But ProScan is, and I'll send you what it is after this, and I'll link it below for people that are curious. It basically breaks down your style of communication, working, meeting, personal time into like an interesting matrix. And at first I was like, this is kind of bullshit. So I was like, I need to find someone to test this with. Cause the most interesting, it's not as interesting, like Myers-Briggs is interesting, like how it works for you, but the ProScan, you can get yours and then you can also get someone else's and then compare them. And that's where it gets interesting. So I was like, who else better to compare a ProScan with my mother, right? So my mom got it done too. My mom is also Boston startup, you know, very involved. So her and I see eye to eye in a lot of things, very similar, but very different. And we found it was like scarily accurate. So I love data.
I should figure out. Yeah. I'm always interested in these things. So awesome. I'll go check it out for sure. Thank you.
So before we dive deep on your day-to-day and what you do with your clients and everything Afer mentioned, how would you describe the work you do now to your 8-year-old self?
So I try to explain it at least to my 11-year-old son that there are some incredible people out there in the world who have ideas on how to improve human health and the climate, like solving diseases that haven't had cures yet, or figuring out ways to conserve energy or to find new ways to do things. Mm-hmm. And these people are typically scientists and they're starting companies and they're new to starting companies. And my job is to help them learn how to grow healthy companies so that their ideas can flourish and the world can be better.
Amazing. And this is a newer thing that you started a few years ago, right? And you transitioned from, was it PE or was it just investment or what?
Yeah. So I was on the founding team of Petrie, which is an early stage venture capital firm located in Boston. And it was right at the sort of cusp of what, I guess, I don't know if we came up with this name, but it was definitely a name that emerged during that time, the founder-led biotech movement. Mm-hmm. The idea of like first-time technical founders, like, can we create a pathway and illuminate this pathway and help them stay on as CEOs of their companies as their companies grow, so they don't have to just like, you know, sell them to another organization to scale? Like, can they stay on and do it themselves? And so I was on the founding team to really think about, my background's learning. And so my background was really to think about like, what do first-time technical founders need? How do we surround them with the right people and resources and connections so that they can grow faster than their companies. Mm-hmm. And to me, I deeply believe that to have thriving technical organizations, you have to have thriving human organizations.
Agreed.
And so I spent a lot of time thinking about how to train these first-time technical founders on how to think about like building human, what I call human-first organizations.
Yeah. Amazing. I'm while you were saying that, I've already thought of like four founders I work with that I need to introduce you to because I think that's a, it's a, that transition from technology or science as what is called deep tech, right? Yep. Into something doesn't even have to be profitable, into something that can provide value to a larger scale than beyond a lab, right? Yep. That is the area in which I live. And it's actually interesting because you asked me the question, you know, how did I discover you? And I had to think for a second, then I realized that like the people that are co-connected with us are like three of some of the most like talented individuals when it comes into that space of like scientist or other individual that cares about science into that. It's a fascinating world that I also operate in. And I just think that more and more people need to, I would say people is the wrong word, more and more scientists or science adjacent people have to take their ideas and start to grow them, right? Like I think the amount of research products that exist in the top 50 research universities, I'd say 90% of them within a year could turn into functional companies, right? That are bringing these solutions out to the world, right? So I appreciate what you do. Thank you. So kind of going off that, right? You call it founder to leader. And are you a one person shop? Like this is just your, okay.
No. Tell me more. It originally started that way. I'll be honest, like when I first started, I wanted to, you know, do the work that really interested me and I was really passionate about, which is working with founders, which really was the work I had done at Petri that I loved the most. The venture firm was really thinking about like how to support these founders. So I really wanted to keep doing that, but I also wanted to have more control over my life. As you can hear, I'm a mom and I have an 11-year-old, and venture life's pretty hard to balance with being a parent. Mm-hmm. And so a piece of it was like, oh, I'll just like open up shop. And, you know, I calculated exactly how many hours of coaching I'd need to do to be able to make back my salary. And that was like as big as I was thinking back then, was just like, okay, so if I have like 18 hours of coaching or 20 hours of coaching a week, like this, like I'll do good. I'll feel great about it. Yeah. Like it's going to be cool. It's going to be cool. Yeah. But I announced on LinkedIn, like, hey, I'm going to open up this shop. Anyone want to come work with me? And within a month, I was at maximum capacity. Like it blew me away. You know, that's like awesome. I was not expecting that kind of sort of reaction from the ecosystem. I was so honored and flattered that so many people were like, yeah, I'd like to come work with you. And it was cool because I hadn't really defined very specifically like how. And a lot of people had really interesting ways of interpreting like how to use me, which was kind of cool too. And so I did a lot of like just on the ground co-creation with the founders of like, what do you need? How can I help you? It was like customer discovery, but real time. And as I started to go along my journey, I realized that I was onto something and that like, actually I didn't want me to be the limiting factor. That if all of these founders were reaching out, and I mean, it takes a lot to reach out for help, right? To say like, I want help and I'm ready to get help and I'm asking you to help me. And I took that very seriously. Like, if there are these first time founders who just got money and they're, you know, starting to grow their organizations and they're reaching out to me for help, I don't want to let them down. So I started slowly inviting trusted friends and colleagues to see what would happen if they worked with some of my clients.
Cool.
And so it's now an operation of me and six other women.
It's awesome. Yeah. I was just looking at your site. So
Yeah. So it's, there's actually, seven of us. The seventh hasn't been announced yet, but she will be very soon. And, it's growing in a really beautiful way.
That's awesome. So, and apologies for not, you know, checking beforehand. I was just asking it for more of a understanding question. So as someone that has not only worked with a lot of executive coaches, not just from like helping set it up, but also talking to you directly.
Yeah.
I think that the general consensus, and I'd love for you to weigh in on this, that I get from most founders, especially technical founders, which as you know, is a whole different breed, are pretty resistant to maybe starting coaching. Mm-hmm. And I think it might be a price thing. It might be a time thing. It might be a non-belief thing. So what would your kind of pitch be to a technical founder listening to this that might, you know, be curious by what you said, but not sure if it's right for them or how it can help them, you know, and make that investment worth it, right?
Yeah. I say I'm not in the convincing business, to be honest. Like I've found that if someone's not ready to do this work, then it's not the right time. It's like, you know, in many ways, it's like going to therapy. You get what you are, you know, when you're ready, you get a lot out of it.
Totally.
And one of the things that I do love about this community of founders is that so many of them are eager and excited to get help. You know, it's an interesting moment where you've been an expert in one domain. You've got a PhD in a field that you know a ton about, but our system, our academic system is not very good right now at training people to have, you know, parallel skill sets at this, you know, and there's a really big gap. And so they're, you know, getting funding, quite a bit of funding, and they often have never had any leadership positions. They've never had a good manager. They don't have any idea how to do any of this stuff. And the stakes are really high, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think many of them, rightfully so, recognize that if they're going to succeed out of the gate, they're going to need some help.
Totally.
And so I actually don't think that many of them, at least the ones that I work with, they don't need convincing. And often it's their friends, their trusted friends, who say, hey, I'm working with Jay and her team. It's been really helpful. And then that's how they end up at my door. So if someone's not ready to do the work, it's really not fun. And I have actually parted ways with a couple of clients who, you know, were clearly not ready to do the work. So yeah, I'm not in that convincing, but I will say that if I'm doing my job well, and this actually a potential client was asking me this in sort of an interview this week of like, well, how do I know if it's working? You know, like how do you quantify whether executive coaching is working? And I'm like,
technical founder for you.
Yeah. And I'm like, yeah. Well,
how do I quantify?
I'll tell you this, that if after an hour of working together, I haven't helped you solve some problem, then it's not working.
Totally.
So like you are really busy, this costs time and money. And if it's not providing value, then you should stop. You know, like
agreed.
That's my job is to help you. But as a firm, we're very much like coaches have all different types of spices and flavors and like ways of being. And I'd say like, we very much have a bias towards action as a team. We're very much about building. We're operators. So like we believe in what we call like I didn't coin this term, just in time learning. It's like, you're going to learn what you need to learn when you need to learn it.
Yeah.
So like you come to me, we're going to solve a problem. We're going to help you untangle that mess. Let's keep you accelerating. Let's go. And so we've built this toolbox based on all of our work with founders, and we're sort of building it real time as clients come with us, like, I have a need, I have a problem, I have this, I have that.
Sure.
All right, let me build you a tool. Let me build you a template. Let me build you a worksheet. Let me build you a thing so that when we talk about it in our coaching session, you understand the theory. Mm-hmm. And then when you leave, you have something to help you go back to your team and deploy it right away. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's something that like for us has become a bit of a differentiator is the idea that like we're really quite tactical about like, okay, what can we do to just help you pick up speed in growing your team in all the right ways?
Totally.
So I'd say to answer your original question about like, why work with a coach? If you work with a great coach, it can really, really help you get there further faster.
Oh yeah. I mean, I can speak from experience myself. I had someone that helped me and ended up same thing parting. It was like a mutual parting of ways. Cause like, I just kind of hit a point where I had to just put my head down and build. And I was like, there's just no value to this moving forward. Right.
Yeah.
And I think both her and I came to that agreement at the same time. It was like, this is just not going to be worth either of our time. So great. So how many of the companies, in this case, I'm going to treat the individuals, that you consult or, mentor or, coach or whatever word you want to use, and the companies they run as kind of one-to-one, because obviously sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't, but, how many of them will ask you to get involved on like a advisory board level or a board level or some other kind of higher level than just what you're doing?
That's a good question. So I will say the way that I work and we work as a team is not always just one-to-one. And so like we work across the company, I mediate, run workshops. I mean, we're quite sure. fluid in the way that we move throughout an organization and the way that we sort of pass clients across the coaching team mm-hmm. where we have different area of expertise.
I love that. Yeah.
So it's like, we try to make it really seamless for our clients. If one of them has a fundraising question, Kate's the girl, right? If they've got a marketing branding question, they should go to Catherine. If they've got a product strategy question, M's your person, cool. you know? So, so all of us sort of have a general skill set and also an area of expertise that we're like particularly well suited to help with. Hmm. In terms of, do I join advisory boards or whatnot? So typically at the startup level, I tend to operate behind a C-suite lead person.
Sure.
But what started to happen is a lot of accelerators and venture funds have started to use me in more of an advisor capacity. Mm-hmm. And so I'm starting to work with a bunch of different organizations like the Engine at MIT, mm-hmm. the Tamir Foundation, Activate Fellowship Program,
yep.
Age One Fund, like a bunch of different Convergent Research, a bunch of different organizations to help them think about like program design and resources and like much more advisory consulting capacity about leveraging what we've seen from pattern matching across so many organizations, but also mm-hmm. my background is in teaching and learning. And Got so it. A lot of this is about, you know, design principles about adult learning.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And I appreciate that explanation because I think that a lot of individuals that could be seeking this type of help immediately, like this is actually thing I've heard a lot. And I'm curious if you've heard it too. If they're saying like, no, we don't need any more advisory board members. It's like, no, this is not an advisory board member. This is like, this is someone for you. This is not for the company. It's for you.
Yeah.
And you need help.
Yeah. And in fact, some of the things that I love doing is like helping the CEO behind the scenes help the board become a more effective board to support them. I ran a retreat recently for a client of mine, and that was such rewarding work going to run an on-site for the board in,
That's awesome.
You know, and to just like help them become a more high-functioning group so that the CEO had more support from them.
Did you find that in this particular example, this company, this group, this board you workshop with, were they Was everyone receptive to this? There's always one person that's probably like the odd duck out that's like, this is BS, you know? But like in your general experience, are people, you know, usually open to this kind of change or are they against it and you have to convert them? Like what is the mix usually?
Yeah. I mean, so I'm also pretty data driven myself. I spent a while at MIT. And so numbers are how
happened?
Yeah. Well, and so I'm not, as I said, in the convincing business, but before that retreat, I went and created a survey for quantitative and qualitative information. Mm. I also interviewed everyone individually on the board and found a way to reflect that. And so instead of me convincing them, they convinced themselves with the data that I collected from them so that they could see that there were some areas that were really ripe for some growth or investment in sort of figuring out. And so I didn't want to have to convince them. I think the data convinced them.
Yeah. Honestly, that's, I love how you keep saying like, you're not in the business of convincing because it's so true, right? It's like, I think in the past few months, I've really turned around my own business and my own studio to be like, I'm going to stop chasing after the companies I'd love to work with and start finding the companies that would love to work with me and vice versa. Right. Right. And it's like it kind of, you know, not to sound too much like a hippie, but it's like very in the flow now, you know, you just like kind of let it come. And it's amazing. Once I stopped pushing, everything kind of came and I was like, oh, I should have done this years ago, but hindsight is 2024. So, As they say, because I like this thing is people now say hindsight is 2020, and it just makes me think of like 2020 and what everyone down everywhere.
Not the year,
not the year. So, something that came to my mind that I really want to, I think we're probably going to be one of the most popular questions I ask on this podcast, and I'll probably use this one for the little media clip, is, you know, so you're active on LinkedIn like everyone else in our world is. I'm sure you see lots of terrible advice. Like, what is the advice you see most often that makes you just want to like scream at the top of your lungs and like, you know, try to be like, please do not listen to this advice, if anything?
I'll be honest, I'm not a very serious consumer of probably any smart. Social media.
Yeah, it's probably good.
I don't have a lot of spare time, and I don't find that it's particularly productive or healthy. I like to see what the founder community is up to and who's hiring who and who's moved to this organization and that. And so in that regard, I'm not really consuming that information with that lens. And so I don't really think I have a critical piece of feedback I want to share. Also, I like to be positive.
Sure.
So
that's kind of anti-Boston of you, but sure. Yeah.
So, I mean, I really don't have like a critique for anyone. And honestly, like, what do I do on social media other than check to see what, you know, the community's up to is.
Which is what it should be used for, right?
That's really what I do. And I like to promote, you know, the founders in my community who are, you know, doing things or looking for things or supporting my teammates. But other than that, I use social media for like looking at puppies and plants and like fun things when I just need a break at lunch.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I have a really good answer for you for that one, unfortunately.
That's fine. I'm going to kind of switch the question to something that I think you will have an answer for, which is, what is a commonly held belief that a lot of founders, when they're starting to work with you, have that you think is something that is like one of the biggest obstacles or uphill battles or something that, you know, takes a lot of time to kind of change, if that makes sense?
I wouldn't say I'd have to change it, but I think there's a huge aha moment where people realize, I think, a couple of things. One, that this human stuff is really hard. That like, you got this far with a cool idea around technology, but now comes actually the people part of building, and people are complicated, and it's a lot of work. And so I think most of my technical founders have like a little bit of an aha moment once they go from like, you know, 3 to 5 to suddenly 15, there's this big moment where they're like, whoa, I'm spending so much time on people stuff. And you're like, yeah,
too much. Yeah,
it's true. Yeah. Right. And so I'd say like just the amount of attention and work that the people part takes is usually a surprise.
Sure.
And the other thing that goes with that is that in order to be able to not have it consume and for it to be positive and productive, a lot of technical founders don't realize how early on you have to put systems and structures in place.
Yeah. It's everything.
It's everything. And so those would be kind of the two biggest early stage aha moments for folks, is realizing like, wow, the people stuff really matters. And like, I guess I need to, you know, put some systems and structures in place right away. That's how if you invest before you have the problems in setting up the right infrastructure, the right, you know, then that makes it possible to scale.
Totally. You know? And know that these systems will change. I think one of my favorite books on building systems is Elad Gil's High Growth Handbook. And he mentions,
have it right back there. Yep. Yeah.
And it's mentioned often that, you know, every time your company doubles in size, you're throwing out most of the systems you created. But if you create the right foundation from the ground up, it's everything. I mean, my most recent example from the past few weeks is, so with the studio I run, half the clients are startups that I don't like using the word consult, we work with. And the other half are ones that want to bring a member of my team or me into it. And so recently I got brought into a company as CTO, which I'll be able to announce next week what the name is. But it's all about waste of energy. And it's something where I got brought into a startup early last year with a guy that was just really unpleasant to work with. And I just realized after a few months, I was like, he's never going to pay me. He's never going to give anyone comp. Nothing was in writing. Like, it was one that, like, you see that a lot, unfortunately, these days. So stay away. But this was something that, you know, they came to me It was kind of a mutual, like, but they were the ones who said, hey, you want to come and see what this is like? And it just naturally came about. But again, this is a process that has been, you know, worked on by a father and son for 30 years, and they've solved some of the major shortfalls that a lot of these existing systems have. And so the company's growing so rapidly. And, you know, as chief technology officer, you know, my role will change, but I basically told them that for the first half year, I only want to focus on building internal systems for people and technical. That's all I want to focus on. And I'll happily help with other things. But like at first it took me to convince them, but now we're 3 months in and they're all like, thank God, you know, cause everyone now is like, oh, okay, we have a solution for that.
So one of my clients, one of my early clients, it was the Concerto Bio team located in Boston. They're Activate Fellows, spin out of the Broad Institute. Three co-founders, they came to me and said, you know, none of us have ever managed anybody before. We're about to scale. We just raised a series, you know, we're about to bring in a lot of people. Can you teach us the absolute bare necessities of what we need to know?
Yeah.
So I designed this class for them, which is now a bread and butter of our coaching practice. We just call it Management 101. Cool. But it's like, if you're a first time technical person, a CEO or C-suite or anyone who's managing anyone, what are the absolute like basic things you need to understand about how management works? And that to me is one of the most essential levers for scaling, is making sure that everyone who manages somebody has the same understanding and framework and principles and practices around how to manage effectively. And so that has become actually a really important practice of ours, is that class, as a way of helping sort of the sort of leaders of all levels in the org really have frameworks for understanding how these systems and structures should work to promote positive human outcomes.
I love that. And looking at your kind of core synopsis for Management 101, is that delivered, is it synchronous and asynchronous, or what have you found is most successful with?
Yeah, we do it both ways. So at first it was live, and then I turned it into a hybrid course where I've pre-recorded myself. And so that's really, I've got a couple of big clients who really like that model, because the founder, it's like all of the sound bites are in 15 to 20 minute, you know, teeny little like in between pipetting or whatever you're doing, you can like sneak that
jump
in.
Yeah.
And then I come live for just an open Q&A for 6 weeks straight. So they do about an hour of watching the content that I've created, short little videos, and then we come live. But some people prefer a more interactive live. So I can do it both ways. And it really depends on the community. Like the Activate Fellowship program, I'm doing it twice for them this year. And it's that hybrid model. And for the Engine, I'm doing it live in person, over lunch, you know, like an early lunch or whatever. So I'm flexible in how I can deliver it based on, you know, what each community think would be best for their needs.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I'm always curious asking about courses and education, because it's something that I've always been interested in, would love when the time is right and the knowledge base and the team is right to build out those kinds of resources. Because I think that we're existing in a world that people are getting more and more interested in learning about the things they care about, because we're kind of pushing away from this mentality that everyone has to know all these, this insane amount of general knowledge, and people can just focus if they'd like to. So, and also, you know, it builds out the mentality of like, build once, sell 10 times, you know, so you can, you know, better arbitrage your time. Right. So it'd be interesting to see how that scales out. But, you know, so it sounds like that a lot of the tenets of what you're teaching is also things that you're using internally to scale your own team, which is fascinating. So it's like, not only are you using these things to help people, but you're also using them internally. So is there a situation or a recent experience where like you and your fellow team members like almost caught yourselves being like, wait, how do we not do this? Because we do this every single day for someone else. Like has that happened?
Yeah, actually, I found myself embarrassingly delayed in writing our own values as an organization. It's like, you know, what they say about the cobbler's children never have shoes or whatever.
Yeah, that's a great saying. Yeah,
I just I was like, you know, I'm a huge fan of as early as you can draft up some values that mm-hmm. are the backbone of your organizational culture.
Totally.
And I had been so busy building and sort of keeping up with everything that I hadn't done that for us. I was very embarrassed by that. And so I finally did it with my team. You know, I drafted something up and asked for feedback and refining it. And everyone had some really beautiful feedback. But I was really embarrassed that that took me way longer than it should have based on what I preach.
I think that's pretty standard for anyone running anything that helps scale, right? It's just like, it's a very, you know, for me and my company, like, I have this internal deck that we use as just a way to share information and ideas. And then I pull out certain slides for sales or certain slides for this. It's just like how we operate. And there's definitely better ways, but it's just what we all like. And sometimes I'll catch myself like putting off very important, like things that'll take me 10 minutes to sit down and do, but I'm like, I don't have time for that. But like 2 weeks later, I'm like, I really should have written this down because I just signed a contract that like invalidates one of the key things we're trying not to do. So do you have any advice for anyone out there starting anything? It could be a technical startup. It could just be a startup in general. It could be an e-commerce business. It could be anything about like where to start. Because it can be so overwhelming, right? Like there's so many things to cover and so many things to do. Like what is a good, like it could be a book. It could be a something to start with. Like what do you recommend?
That's a great question. I mean, it really depends on where you're building and what you're hoping to achieve. It's right. It's hard to give blanket advice, right? Like, it's funny in many ways. I am like, oh, you should really go talk to potential customers before you build anything. 100%, you know.
Sure.
And in some ways, I'm like, I didn't do that. But in many ways, like my several years of working at venture, like working directly with founders, was customer discovery, you know? So in many ways I'm like, oh, did I do that? I don't know. I guess I did do that.
What do you mean I have to talk to customers? That wasn't part of the plan.
So, I mean, it's funny, but like, I mean, make sure what you're building or what you want to build is something that is useful. You know, like that's like the number one thing is there some white space? And is that white space of value to, you know, either impact or revenue or however you define, you know, success, you know. So I always think about, you know, the way I think about it often is like, if you were to go camping in the forest.
I like where this is going. Yeah.
Okay. If you were to go camping, like think about where you'd want to put your tent. Right? Do you want to pick an area that's really densely populated with trees and you're going to have to chop a tree down in order to create a flat enough space to put your tent down? Or could you find an area that's already cleared and already pretty flat and it would be pretty easy to put that tent up and find some shelter? Right? And so like to me, that's always the low-hanging fruit of getting started with anything is like where is that open playground and let's map the perimeter of what that space is. And now we can start to innovate. I was an intrapreneur before I was an entrepreneur. And so that is a lot of my experience is figuring out how do I elbow out some space that can be mine and I can play in this. And without a lot of like serious competition or red tape or politics and sort of like, you know, I was an entrepreneur at MIT and at Harvard. And so in many ways, that's the only way is you can find a pocket where no one's paying attention or no one cares or, you know, something or it's a big enough problem. And so like, in addition to, I'd say, make sure you talked to customers, you know, make sure that you also have some opportunity, some space.
I love that. I think sometimes I find using the same analogy, I always like to ask people in this case, like, why do you want to go camping? Right. And what are you trying to solve by camping? Or maybe like, what is the outcome? Right. Because I just recently I was helping I'll leave it nameless. Someone very close to me start a coffee business and I was going to help them with just some like basic you know, branding and help design a label and help figure out manufacturing and like the process of shipping and, you know, A to Z basic kind of for an e-commerce business. And I asked that simple question and it kind of like, people look at you like you have eight heads. I'm like, why are you doing this? They're like, because I want to. And it's like, no. It's like there always is a reason, right? And if there isn't a reason, then I need to know that. And if there isn't, then it's hard for me to understand. And so as you could probably imagine, like trying to build someone just to even an introductory 10% of what the brand could be, just need to get like a prototype product out there with their name on it. It's like, if I don't know what you're doing and why you want to do it, then it's very hard for me to put any kind of value on that or any kind of like definition on that. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it's what's a little different is like, because I work in this deep tech space, primarily in biotech and some climate tech or tough tech, however you want to call it.
Sure.
For the most part, people are already doing this work because they have a shared goal of doing something good for the world. Sure. And so in that regard, I mean, making money is often the secondary goal.
Or tertiary,
But it's often, and that's why I do this work, and this is why I'm in this particular space working, is that I've always cared like about impact. And that's been my driving force my whole life, is like, where can I do the best good for the world? And so in that regard, I think that like most of the founders that I work with already have that question answered a bit of like, we want to help patients, or we want to, you know, cure cancer, or we want to, you know, whatever it is already.
Hmm. Yeah. It's such an interesting thing. And obviously it depends, like, cause I work with all kinds of, I guess, ventures. So, you know, my background is aerospace engineering. So I have a lot of aerospace, and there is kind of like my niche, but there's been a lot of biotech recently. There's been a lot of nonprofits actually recently, which is fascinating because there's a lot of nonprofits that operate like startups and for-profits, but they're still nonprofits. And those are actually really fun to work on because it's like the easiest ask in the world for an investor. They're looking for $14 million. What's their valuation? They're a nonprofit. Great, I'll send you a check tomorrow. You know, it's like, because all these people, they need a tax hedge, right? So it's my favorite people to raise money for by far, as you could probably imagine.
I already know a client you should talk to of mine.
Really? Okay, happy to. Okay. So I kind of want to get into some nitty-gritty details and some specific things I've seen that you've worked on or been involved with, or things you've posted and talked about. So first, Arcadia, right? This is hard for me to say because I've worked on branding and existence for a lot of biotech companies. They have some of like the most cohesive branding of any biotech startup I've ever seen, right? To describe it to anyone, and I'll link it below, it's just like, it reminds me of like a really nice children's book that actually has really good information. It makes me feel like calm, and it's like they're trying to teach me something, but also like is very technically accurate, if that makes sense. I don't know how to describe it, but it's also very complex. Which is the opposite of like what our friend Andrea wanted to do with HoloClara. So it seems like, you know, I asked you a question earlier about like how many of the startups will ask you to be like an advisor or come on board. And with them, you list yourself as an advisor. So I'm curious, like, was that a relationship that went from like coaching to advising, or you started as an advisor? Mm-hmm. Like what has that been like? And what is that experience working with them? Cause they've been doing a lot of really cool stuff. Been like,
yeah. So I was a translation advisor, which is different than just being an advisor. So, I mean, translation for those who are not in biotech is the process of taking an idea out of academia into the real world. And so that word means something different to people who aren't in that space. So just, I want to make sure that that word makes sense to people who are listening. Yeah.
You're not translating content for the Chinese market. No.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So, I mean, that was really leveraging my experience in venture, you know, of helping them as a bunch of academics at the time who were trying to figure out how to, in a totally new model, create a space where ideas can become impactful without some of the hurdles that are in the way in existing models. And so I was on, with a group of actually other incredible women, helping to think this through with them. And so I wore a lot of hats while I was there. It was kind of a beautiful synergy that CME was starting, you know, the organization at almost the exact same time as I was starting Founder to Leader.
That's amazing.
She didn't know exactly how to use me, and I didn't really exactly know, but we just said, like, there's something here. Let's figure out how to start working together. And they were a really deep client for quite a while of mine, where I was, you know, nearly one day a week helping them with a range of things just to get off the ground. And I've done that before for other organizations where, you know, they have big scale, big, quick ramp up, and I've sort of been more than just a theoretical coach or advisor, but gotten in there and actually helped them build a little bit. And so I do try to be cautious of when I cross over which hat I'm wearing, so that, you know, I'm in a coach capacity at this moment. I'm in a consulting capacity in this moment. I've done that for the Convergent Research team as well. Yeah. So, like, you know, I'm going to be a coach to the CEO, but then if there's a specific project they need muscle on and no one else on the team can do it, I'm happy to hop in and just like muscle with you for a little bit. So, in that regard, I think for them, I just sort of bopped around a bunch of different hats where they didn't at that point have quite enough people. And, you know, and so I just sort of would be a 0 to 0.5 for them for a bunch of things to help them figure out, like, what do we need to do to actually create a job here? Or like, let's scope this out and figure out like what we need. So
but that's in that 0 to 0.5 is huge. So
So that, I mean, that explains sort of what I was doing with them there, was trying to figure out how to be helpful as they think about their model, with a translation framework in mind.
Cool. So kind of going off that and involving another question I asked earlier about, you know, people that may be hesitant to utilize a service like yours. I think also another problem is sometimes people, it just like, this happens. I see it with my friends and finding psychologists as well. It's really hard to find the right one. So do you have any general advice for people looking? Cause it's like, it's one of those things that at least you have like Psychology Today and you can go look at a, like a whole, but like, does that exist for coaching?
I mean,
it should.
So like a lot of venture capital firms do list coaches that they have vetted. And so I would say if you don't know where to start, that's typically a good place to go, is to go, a bunch of VC firms will list like, you know, some vendors that they've worked with.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's like the equivalent, I think, of Psychology Today for coaching. I think the best thing to do if you're thinking about working with a coach is to ask your founder friends or your investors, like who they've seen have traction. For me specifically, like I work with kind of niche groups where I do think having content expertise of like really understanding how biotechs work and really understanding how tech, they're really different than a SaaS company or from, you know, other types of organizations. So I do think that there are some types of startups that it's better suited to have someone who really understands your specific field very well. I think biotech is one of them. And then ask people in your network for people they've recommended and make a short list and then go and talk to them and see if there's some chemistry. If you align philosophically on how they think about the role of a coach. And if you just like, you know, feel comfortable talking to them and feel like this is someone I could trust, I could open up to, and who, if I, you know, there was a dumpster fire, I'd call them to help me figure out what to do. For us at Founder Leader, we try to make it really easy to get started. So first off, we have a sliding scale for payment so that you pay what you can, you know, we have a pre-seed rate that I think is quite affordable. Folks don't bat an eye at it. The last thing we want to do is make getting help at this stage price prohibitive.
Yeah.
So we're really mindful about making sure that we're like pricing ourselves appropriately for
that's really with. Smart. Yeah. I actually haven't seen that often. And whenever I do, I'm really appreciative of it because there's some people that are really good, but they just have a flat rate that like,
it's like, you can't justify that when you have, you know,
if you raise $100 million, who cares? Totally. But like when you're operating off a $120,000 check, like no way. Right.
You know, when you're not paying yourself. The ROI has to be there 100%. Yeah. Right. So that's one thing we do to lower the barrier for people is we make the pricing really affordable. And I actually even have a student rate. I have a couple students who are working with me as they're wrapping up their PhD and like kudos to them.
Yeah.
So we really try to like meet folks where they are. Mm-hmm. And then we really try to think about, you know, like either if someone comes up with a very targeted problem, we'll be like, we can solve that in 5 hours of coaching. That's all you need to pay for. And we'll just chunk it for like, what do we think you need to solve this problem?
That's awesome. Yeah.
But we'll also say, well, let's start. If someone wants like an ongoing coaching relationship, we'll say, well, why don't we just do 3 months and see what it's like to work together? And if at the end of 3 months, it's not working, like we have a chance to reevaluate, you know, obviously, you know, sooner rather than later if things, you know,
always. Yeah.
But like most of the time we try to make it really easy for people to just de-risk starting. And then they always come back for more and more and more.
Sure.
Once they see the value. And that's our job is to make sure we're delivering that value.
Totally. So you're basically hedging the future customers based on giving them a rate at which they can afford at any point in time.
Yeah, exactly. So as folks raise, our rate goes up just ever so slightly to reflect the fact that you now have more resources as an organization.
Totally. And I we use the same thing in my company. If there is an individual coming in that has an idea and wants to turn into a company, it's not the same amount I'm going to charge to someone that already has $10 million in the bank. And exactly. Some people really don't like that. And I have the same response. Like, I just don't give a fuck. Like I'm sorry.
I am with many of my clients for the long haul. You know, I have some folks who I've been with for a couple years now. There's a woman I coach who was at the Broad Institute, and I helped her get the courage to leave the Broad and start the, you know, and get her co-founder. And she got her first 50K and her first customer. And like, you know, I know that. Yeah. It's like, I mean, that's why we do this, right? Yeah.
I mean, these are your kids, right? Like they're your totally. They're your kin, right?
Not they're kids, growing up.
Your kin, yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, it's great. And I think one thing you said that I will reemphasize for anyone listening to this interested in doing anything where you're helping people, it's like, not only is it fun, like I have so much fun. It seems like you have a lot of fun too.
I do.
But also like at any point in time, if the right opportunity came along for you personally, you could say, I'm going to do 90% founder to leader, and I'm going to spend 10% with this one company because this is an amazing opportunity. And that actually helps. It doesn't cannibalize anything, right? It increases.
Yeah.
So totally. Yeah, no. And I think I found something that I will double back what you said, which is if you do right by people and prove that it's worth the value in the long run, they will not only rely on you when they need things, but also they don't care how much you're charging as long as it's fair. Right. And I think that's everything. Right.
Yeah. I mean, my job is to be helpful, and if I'm not, then you shouldn't keep coming back. Right.
Totally. Yeah. Do you, actually, so this is an interesting question. So if someone, for example, was to, you know, be interested, it sounds like there's an interview where you just at least get that first kind of chemistry. Do you charge for that interview session or no?
No.
Good. I only say good because during COVID, I like tried out a couple psychologists, and after the first one, it was like a 30-minute call, and we were just trying to figure things out and get the feeling. Yeah. And after she's like, "Ooh, sorry, 30 minutes is up. So I'll send you a bill for $120." And I'm like, "Excuse me, like we're not like I told her point blank. I was like, "I'm not paying that because part one, you never told me in the first place. And if I'd agreed to it, that's a different story. But part two, it's like we're living in a world these days where I saw two separate posts, one on LinkedIn and one on Twitter yesterday, and like on people adjacent to my network, thankfully not in my network, who were like, we now have so much money to deploy in our fund. We're charging $100 just to come and talk to us so we can give them money." And in my head, I'm like, go fuck yourself. Because like if you have that much money and you have too many people coming to you, then hire more people to help you sort through them, right? I just believe that's
true. That doesn't line up for my values at all.
Me neither.
Like 100%. And I'll be honest, you know, like We have nothing if we don't have the trust of our founders. You know, in order to be able to work across organizations, in order to be able to work within, across teams, within organizations, if folks don't believe that like we are truly trusted through and through, we have absolutely nothing. Yeah. And so I'm never going to do anything that is surprising or that is in any way like that.
Full transparency always.
Yeah, 100%. Like I'm just, that's just not my value system there.
I love that. Yeah. And I hope more and more start operating that way. Cause yeah, there's nothing worse than people who overvalue their time. Right. I think that's the best way to do
it. Yeah. I mean, honestly, like you said before, like we have to preach what we say. And like, I'm a firm believer that as leaders, one of the worst things that you can do for your team is have surprises. Mm-hmm. Right. And so like, I try to never have surprises for any of my clients either. Surprises yeah. make us feel unsteady and make us feel like we're not sure what's happening next. And that sort of psychological unsafety can make it totally. Really hard to build. And so I'm going to do everything.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure there are never surprises mm-hmm. with anybody who works with my team.
Yeah. Yeah. The amount of quote unquote founders or VCs I've worked with that I've just blacklisted at this point that have always been like, oh yeah, we'll give you equity and we'll pay you this much. And like a day before the contracts due, they were like, oh, we're actually not going to pay you. We didn't feel like the time was valuable. Like, yeah, it's like, it always like, bye. Like it's a very clean, like see ya. And then the weird thing is that every single one of them will always talk poorly about you. They're like, oh, they wasted my time. Oh, they were taking advantage of me. And that's just like, I don't know what happened to you or who hurt you. I'm sorry. But like, that's not what happened. And I think, you know, I just recently rewrote our entire, so with Afocal, my studio, we worked a lot of early stage startups, a lot of deep tech, and we help raise a lot of money. And what I basically am trying to build is a syndicated network of VCs that I know personally and have met that are basically like, I would love to have almost like an investor room, literally and figuratively digitally, where I say, hey, a new startup came in. They already know that anything we touch is above board and has been passed off by us. And before I go out publicly, is anyone interested? And usually almost recently, I've covered the entire round with just that group. And that's awesome because I get to keep it. Awesome. And I'm trying to build more. But there's two things I instituted. I have seen more cannibalistic, aggressive, demonstrative fundraising contracts in the past year than ever. I saw one recently and they wanted $12,000 a month as a retainer and 7% of all money raised on money they brought in and 2% on money brought in that they didn't intro in perpetuity. And I was like, do people actually sign this? And the sad thing was, yes, is they're taking advantage of early founders that think this is normal. I think this is like what it costs. Like it shouldn't cost anything but time, right? And it's really scary because that's a lot of money, right? And so our rule is like 5% is pretty standard. We stop at 3. 3 is the max. Like I will never take more than 3% of money raised. And that's with zero retainer. So that's like covering everything, creation and talking and network. And most of the time we end up waiving the fee anyways because we're like, people are like, so we owe you, you know, 3%. I'm like, well, if you want to do some work with us and we're going to help you do things, like just, we'll just roll that into the next thing, right? Because it's not about making money. It's just about making sure there's skin in the game and exchange of value. I care less about the money and more about there is a connection between us doing something and getting paid for it. Like that is the most important relationship trying to build, if that makes sense. So, but also at the same point in time, like the on the opposite end of that is, we offer 15% to anyone that gives us, you know, so if you were to intro me to a startup and that turns into a $50,000 project, I will give you or founder leaders at 15% of that total contract value. And that's very, very generous, I think.
Yeah, that's
generous. But also, it also means that like, cause the way I run my company is like on an agency model without agency pricing. So like, we're not have massive overhead. So that overhead rather just give to the people helping create the network. And so everyone's compensated because you are basically putting yourself in this case out in the line to say, hey, these are people that you should work with. I vouch for them, right? That to me is worth a hell of a lot more than what people are like, oh, I'll give you 2%. It's like, because that's your reputation, right?
Yeah.
And also it makes people really think hard about, who am I entering to? What am I getting out of this? Because now there's an actual skin in the game, right? So I just want to make it so it's as fair as possible, you know? Because it's not about making money. It's about making cool shit with cool people, always, for us. But yeah, I always push people to say, like, because that's the thing. It's like, if I were to work with a network partner to say they make high quality ads and videos for startups, right? And I set up the project, I do everything with them, and I basically create everything, and then to say, hey, all you have to do now is deliver this. Like, I ask for 15% for setting all that up. And some people are like, that's very fair, or they think it's super unfair. But I'll say, hey, on the flip, all the contracts I send out are two-way. If we find work for you, if you work for us, it's 15% both ways. It's never going to be otherwise. Because because the amount of times I see, especially VC funds with one-way agreements, like, if we give it to you, it's more. But if you give it to us, it's less. It's like, no, it's always equal. I know it's a tangent. I apologize. I just think recently I've seen a lot of posts and people just taking advantage of early stage founders. And it's something I'm trying to stop. So if there's one person listening to this call that realizes that they're getting taken advantage of, send JRI an email and we'll help you out. Please. Because I just want as much, because I believe in abundance. Like, I don't believe in a zero sum game. So I think that, like, there is a path for all of these technologies to coexist and be useful. Do you, this is going to be a hard left turn. So you posted something on LinkedIn that I thought was awesome. And I would just love the full story. Cause I hope that someone else had the question one day and they're like, I saw this, I want to know what happened. You say, listen to this. So, I'm just going to read what you said. You said, I told my 11-year-old son that he can't start a business on Etsy without knowing all the costs and requirements. He just presented his PowerPoint and I made him use primary sources and footnotes. So can you, like, tell the story there? Cause that sounds amazing. sorry to put that out there, but it sounds great.
Yeah, I mean, where to start? So, I have a kid who has ADHD. He's a really cool, really creative kid. And as a parent, just like any great, I mean, being a great parent, I think, is a lot like being a great manager. It's trying to figure out how to meet whoever it is, in this case, my son, where he is, and figure out how to help him on his journey. And, you know, school's been pretty hard for him, but business, which he comes by honestly, is where his passion lies. He's been doing a children's business fair for in our town, which That's is awesome. Done run by the Rotary Club in town. It's like one day a year where these kids work really hard for weeks at a time. And the Rotary Club does a really nice job of giving the kids coaching on Zoom once a week and getting them ready to think about pricing and marketing. And it's really well done, I'll be honest. And then the town hosts it for them, these tents, and they each host their booths and they sell their things. And, you know, this is going to be his fourth year doing it. And it's been really cool to watch his business evolve, his understanding of business evolve. But he was like, you know, it's not enough that it's just one day a year. Like, I should be selling and making money like every day. And I'm like, cool. And so he's been like, I think that I should start an Etsy company because then I can be making money all year off of my business, you know? Mm-hmm. And he makes these like little teeny clay creatures.
That's awesome.
They're really quite good, actually. And so he was like, I really want to start. And I mean, having started a company myself, it's not just that easy. And so I'm thinking to myself, what about taxes? Like, what about, like, do we have to form an LLC? Like, oh God, like, what do I have to do to, you know, like, am I going to have to go to the post office every week for him? Like, what is this going to look like? So I was like, well, and the last thing I want to do is squash his spirit, right? Sure.
Yeah.
So I was like, I want you to do the work to figure out what is it going to take to do this right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was like, you can't look at any, like, if you're gonna, you have to go to the right sources to make sure your information is legit and that you're not like reading some weird, you know,
Reddit thread about
essays. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, no. You need to go to the source. So, I made him, you know, create proper, you know, slide deck for me on what is it going to take to run this business. And after, and it took him a whole day, and he was really stuck with it. I was quite proud of him. And at the end of it, he was like, yeah, this isn't going to work. Shoot. And I was like, And he was really discouraged. And I was like, well, can you think of, you know, founders, one of the most, you know, one of the most common and persistent traits of all the founders that I coach is figuring out how to persevere, how to figure out how to have grit and not give up if you hit a roadblock. So maybe if Etsy is not your thing, like, where could you maybe sell your stuff beyond just a daily fare that would not have all of these issues? And we realized that one of his friends from school, her mom owns a little shop in town. Perfect. So he made a different PowerPoint presentation. And he pitched to her that he should have a shoebox amount of space on her counter to sell his stuff. And they just exchanged cash. And I was like, this kid, you know.
Can I hire him?
I know, right?
Seriously. I know it's normal around 11 if you're a really gifted athlete to get like a scholarship into a school, but like if I can start some kind of pipeline for, you know, preteens and teens to go into business, I think that'd be great. Like we're talking early checks, right?
Like, I mean, really, like I genuinely believe like
pre-seed.
You're gonna do something cool. Like just watch out, world. Yeah. And one day he says to me, sorry.
No, please. What did he say to you?
It's funny. He says to me one day, Mom, do I need to pay you for this advice?
Because he knows what you do and he knows that this is...
He knows what I do. He's like, this is... I mean, should I be paying you for this advice?
What would you say to that?
I was like, no.
No. No, I mean, the amount of times I've bothered my mom for advice on startups or people or contracts. And now it's fun because... Now we both live in the same world and we have experience in different areas. So sometimes she'll solicit me for advice, which always makes me feel really good about myself. And then I always ask her questions, right? I'm like, hey, it's usually the question is phrased one of two ways. It's like, am I crazy for, or it's, is this person being a dick or is it just me? You know, like those are usually the two like veins of the question that I ask my mom. And I just got to say, you know, some unsolicited advice when it comes to your son. As someone who grew up in Massachusetts with ADHD and OCD and like on the spectrum and like didn't get along with kids in school, got bullied all the time, didn't do too well in school, honestly. Like in the subjects I wanted to care about, I excelled, but like I didn't give a crap about Shakespeare. So like I would fail English 2 sophomore year, right? And as someone that, and this is for anyone that has kids out there or wants to have kids, like I didn't try in high school. I slept through class. I had a 2.7 weighted GPA, one of the best high schools in America, right? It's in Massachusetts, Hingham. And I got into one of 18 schools I applied to. And then I got there and kind of realized, I was like, this wasn't the smartest thing for me to do. But then what I realized is like, you know, you use this like founder creation mentality. And I was like, I should find the best engineering schools that will allow me to replace my high school GPA with my first semester freshman year GPA. So suddenly it artificially becomes amazing. And that's how I transferred into like a really good engineering school. My only advice is like, it'll get worked out. I just thank my mom a lot for just letting me kind of just go. Right. Yeah. And realize that like, you know, my parents would get on my ass for getting bad grades and not doing work and stuff like that. But like in a way more like, you know, you kind of have to write your own future, right? You're not doing this for me. Like I always strongly dislike when parents are like paying their kids for grades or being like, you're getting a grade for me. It's like, no, you're not. And it kind of creates this weird environment where I have a lot of friends that have a lot of trauma with their current, you know, higher ups or bosses because they're waiting for this like approval and kind of weird, you know what I'm saying? Like they're waiting for them to be like, good job, sweetie. And like a pat in the head, but that's not how it works. Right. So I really appreciate what you're doing with your son. So I'd be curious to see how that turns out. And was that agreed upon? Are his goods now downtown in the store?
So they will be. And you know, awesome. The cool thing is he's already like, you know, there's a bunch of stores that are locally owned in our town, and we know the owners. And so he was like, wait, this is a model that can scale, that can approach, you know, Nadia, the dumpling daughter, and I could make little dumplings for her to sell on her counter, you know, and like, I could make this. And so, it's cool. It's really cool. And I will say that there's so many parallels between, I think, coaching and parenting, right? Yeah. And in this case, it's like figuring out where to nurture his passion in the right directions and to create some guardrails for him to learn safely. Mm-hmm. I serve as a resource to support you. You're going to lead, and I'm going to give you what you need as you're going on your journey, you know?
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. So, I have a, not an ask, but an offer. So one of the offshoots, really, the podcast came from the magazine, right? It's like we published a print only magazine. I'm going to send you a couple copies after this.
Please. I would love that.
We're working on the second one now. And in every magazine, we feature a couple like little products and things. And I would love to get one of your son's figures in there. I think it'd be awesome.
He would absolutely flipping love that. Yes.
We'll need to figure out a way. And maybe we can have, because we have a full e-commerce site set up. So maybe we can sell them online and I'll just pay him for those. But like, I wouldn't want to put it in there unless we could also sell them. Because I'm not going to say like, hey, go to this one shop in Weston. That's not going to work. But like,
he would be beyond excited.
Yeah. You know? And I think people would dig it. Like I would put one on my desk. I mean, it's the way
it is. Like hundreds of them back here. If you can.
Yeah. It's awesome. That's amazing. Like, and like, I'm a big like nerd. So if there's anything related to like Pokemon or Star Wars, like I'll buy it in a heartbeat. And look, there are plenty of other people out there that will buy it too. So, and if he's doing commissions, like we can talk. Right?
Oh, he would definitely do commissions. Definitely.
That's amazing. Yeah. So, I know we're getting short on time, so I have a couple of rapid fire questions I want to ask you, to kind of get you out of here on. Is there a certain sound that you associate with happiness?
That's a great question. It's funny. The thing that immediately came to mind when you said that was birds chirping. I associate a good nap in my hammock and listening to the birds as just pure happiness. So maybe that's your answer.
Sure. What kind of hammock do you have? And this might be a weird question, but people always ask, like, because everyone's like always looking for a good hammock. So,
really? I don't know. I mean, I have a little campfire in my backyard that's my happy place. Awesome. And it's like probably one of the cheapest hammocks you can get on Amazon. That doesn't, it's not a very fancy one.
I didn't know if it was like one of the ones made of rope, or it was like a solid material, or like one of the
solid material. Yep. It's a solid material. I keep it in my barn so that it stays nice and protected. Awesome. And then when it's nap time and campfire time, it comes on out.
Of course you're a New Englander. You have a barn. Like it's perfect, right? It all works out. Is there something you believe in that most don't?
I think that, I mean, many, many don't, but I truly am an eternal optimist. Mm. I think that's true of most founders, but, I think founders. That, yeah, it's funny. I've taken some really big leaps of faith, doing a lot of things that I think a lot of people would believe are scary, really scary. Mm. Yeah. Starting a company, asking for a divorce, raising a kid, you know, primarily by myself, you know, all these things. And I just firmly believe in my heart that like, it's going to work out. It's going to be okay.
Yeah. I think it's this, and part of it's like, because I talked to my mom about this and I said, whenever I like, because I've been in some financial hardships about other things and lost contracts and that stuff, or it's like, could be a relationship hardship. Like I have this just almost it's ego driven at a level, but like this belief that like, it's just going to be okay. It's like it's all going to work out. Like I just trust myself and I just put my head down and keep moving. And I think that is like, if I don't see that in a founder, I immediately become a lot more hesitant. And then like, we need to find you a co-founder that has that mentality. Cause it doesn't mean you can't succeed, but like I have never seen a startup fail or I should say a founder fail, because companies can fail, but the startup founder can be successful, obviously, if they have the mentality, right? I think it's going to be like the number one thing.
I think a piece of that, like very closely connected to that concept, is the idea that like, and this is something that I think I do a lot of work with my founder clients around, which is like, as a founder, you don't have to have all the answers. You have to know how to find the answers. Yeah. And when you really believe that, nothing seems that impossible, right? It's figuring out how to find the right people or the right resources to help you solve the problem. And so I think if you really deeply believe that, it's like every problem has a solution. Even if I don't see it, I can figure out who I start figuring out who can help me on this, on this path. Right.
It's an optimist abundance mindset. Yeah.
Yeah. Of like, it's okay. Like maybe even if I don't see the solution, like I have really smart friends, I have really smart colleagues. Someone's going to help me figure out how to solve this. Totally. You know?
Yeah. At the end of the day, it'll be figured out.
We'll figure this out. Yeah. Like it's solvable. You know?
Don't worry about it. You know?
We're going to, there's a solution out there. We're going to figure it out.
Is, if you could send a single push notification to everyone's phone or device in a given area, where would it be and what would it say?
This
is the question where everyone pauses the longest. So don't feel like you don't have something immediate. Because it's a lot of responsibility.
That is. I mean, there's a piece of me that's like, go serious, right? And there's a piece of me that's like, don't. Right. So, I mean, there, if I were to get one emoji only, I would probably, the first one would probably be those two hands up. That's like, woot, woot, you know, like, the party emoji. Of like the two hands up. That's like, you go, you rock, you know, just as like, just, I have so many incredible friends, especially women friends who are doing some really brave things. And I just would send the positive, like, I'm excited for you and proud for you. And like, you keep going, you know?
Yeah.
But then there's a piece of me that might pick that dancing owl, 'cause he's just so fun. You know, the one who like shakes. Just like party. Don't.
Yeah. My dad sent it to me once and I was like, I'm glad you know where this is on the keyboard, Dad. yeah. It's like so my parents have been divorced for, since I was six, it was 2001, 2000, 2006 or 2007. I was in first grade. Happened actually at 7:38 a.m. on September 11, 2001 is when the divorce was finalized. For historical significance. So I'll never forget that day for many reasons. But like my parents are so different, right? And I think that that's something I always learn. It's just like, I've learned so much from both parents, but for any children of divorced parents out there, I will say like, there are definitely certain things you should only ask one parent. And that's probably like the most useful thing to learn. And to go off that advice that you were saying, and the reason why I brought that up is like, you know, my dad would send that emoji and think it's cool. My mom would be like, also think it's cool, but not, she'd be the one to give me the real advice. My dad would be like, yeah, let's just go, you know, which is
cool. I think my immediate one was those two hands up, because I think that at my heart of all hearts, I'm also like a big cheerleader.
Sure. Did you grow up cheerleading at all, out of curiosity? You said it like I'm a big cheerleader, and I was like, are you referring to some former career?
Not actually.
Sure. Yeah, I didn't know if you were on some like, you know, Harvard, MIT, Ivy League cheer squad. That could be a thing. No. I think it should be a thing, right? Like not from an actual cheerleader.
But no. Sure.
I'm not talking about pom-pom cheerleaders. I'm talking about like just motivating people, right? Yeah.
I am a big fan of cheering for people, but not.
Sure. Yeah. I take on the cheerleader role very often in startups, and I enjoy that. I'm not going to put pom-poms in my hands and dress up like a cheerleader, but I will be the cheerleader.
I wouldn't be opposed to doing that, but that's not what I do.
So before we, you and I will connect offline shortly after this, is there anything else you'd like to mention or share or have people check out or look at or say?
First off, thank you. This has been really fun, and I've really enjoyed chatting with you about some of my favorite things. I don't really have a take-home message other than like, if you're thinking about starting a startup and you have a technical idea and you're thinking, should I do this? You know, really explore that. The world needs more people innovating 100%. In this space.
Yeah.
So if you think you have an idea and you're not exactly sure how to get going, there are some incredible resources out there to figure out how to take those first steps. And so I would just say, if you're listening and you have an idea, don't like squash that idea, you know, go for it.
That's great advice. Thank you for that. Well, thank you for your time. And I'm going to stop the recording and I'll say goodbye to everyone out in the outro. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening to this conversation with myself and Jay. You can find Jay online just by typing in her name, Jay Goldstein, JayeGoldstein. And you can also find her at her company, Founder to Leader. And as always, you can find me online at Rob is Lost or by typing in Rob Auchincloss. I hope you all have a fantastic rest of your day. Goodbye.